Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to your favorite podcast. This is realestateinvestormba.com. We created Real Estate Investor MBA to leverage the knowledge of giants through synthesizing and providing much needed information to all investors, from the veteran investor to the new and aspiring investor. At Real Estate Investor MBA, we plan to cover pertinent information head on with our expert guests, who we will interview on what they are doing and preparing for in the days and years ahead. We aim to create MBA quality curriculum topics and themes from the information garnered among our interviewed guests in order to bring world-class value to our fellow community of listeners. We truly believe that rising water raises all ships. And by sharing this leveraged knowledge, we can create a stronger online community, which translates to stronger local, regional, and national communities. Your hosts are Jeremy Moyer, who is a veteran real estate investor and author of a new book called Are You Playing the Real Estate Game Blind? As well as Tejas Gosai, the owner of eXp Realty, the Tejas Gosai team, and also co-manager in a newly formed Regulation D private equity fund called the Lehigh Valley Private Equity Fund. Now let's get to the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Real Estate Investor MBA. My name is Jeremy Moyer, one of your hosts. I am flying solo today as my co-host Tejas Gosai was not able to make it. Please check out our website, realestateinvestormba.com. where you can find all of our interviews from our prior guests. A lot of great content's really been shared over the past year since we started. We're also available on several of the podcast platforms such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn. Please subscribe and download all the past episodes to listen to them. And if you think we're providing value, please give us a 5-star review, leave us some feedback. We love to read and review the feedback from our listeners. So now on to the interview today. I'm excited to announce our guest, Bruce Stankavage. Bruce, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So Bruce has been investing in the self-storage industry since 1999. He co-founded North State Storage to own and manage self-storage assets. He acquired both operating facilities and also land where he developed ground-up new construction. In 2013, his company sold 13 locations for approximately $55 million. Shortly after that, he co-founded another company called Outbox Self-Storage to own, manage, and develop self-storage facilities. Prior to entering the self-storage space, Bruce was an area real estate manager for the McDonald's Corporation. He performed market analysis, financial underwriting, and site acquisition duties for restaurant expansion in North and South Carolina. Bruce began his real estate career in 1993 as a commercial broker in the Raleigh-Durham area. And over the course of his career, he has completed over $250 million worth of real estate transactions. Bruce, that's one heck of a resume. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
That's great. So before we kind of get into some of the detailed questions, can you just tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself and how you got started in real estate in your career?
Yep. First of all, I'm married. I have three boys and been married for 26 years as of last week. That's a big deal. So how did I get involved in the real estate industry? Well, kind of by chance in many ways. I was living up in Pennsylvania, went to Lafayette College, up where you're located, and graduated and wasn't sure what to do. My brother owned a real estate company, brokerage company in Durham, North Carolina. And he's like, hey, why don't you come down and join us? I had no idea what I was doing, had no training. I was like, ah, sure, what the heck? And I did. And so packed my bags and moved down to Durham, North Carolina in 1993. So I've been in the business since then.
Wow. That's tremendous. That's right. I forgot you were from Lafayette. It's just around the... not too far from where we're located. Really close to Tejas' office is right downtown Easton. So
office
isn't far from you. Yeah.
Right.
So the McDonald's Corporation, I've heard that the two largest landowners in the U.S. are the Catholic Church and McDonald's. I'm not sure if that's true or not. I thought of that when I read that in your bio the first time I saw it. So how did you get started with McDonald's, and what was that like with site location and feasibility and all that?
Yeah, it was a great experience. I feel like I got my MBA in real estate at McDonald's, sure. Where they were paying me to learn. I got started because one of the brokers in my office, my brother's company, was doing some land acquisition for McDonald's, and one of the real estate area managers left. They were looking to hire somebody, and he recommended me and interviewed. And I remember I got the job, and so it was a big deal for me at that point because I was pretty young in the business, and they usually hire some people with a little bit more experience. But it was a tremendous experience. I mean, just the underwriting that they do, the demographics, the trade area analysis, all kinds of just detailed levels of site selection. It was a tremendous learning experience. And that was really the platform for me to learn and grow to then jump into the self-storage business. If I didn't have that foundation and that background with McDonald's, I couldn't imagine, you know, leaving McDonald's and starting a company looking at self-storage facilities.
That's right. And just the analytics, right, that goes into what you do, what you had to do with the in that position. Yeah, it was definitely a great stepping stone, right? It's very transformational into the self-storage analytics, right? Just what you needed to look
absolutely.
At about data driven. Yeah.
Absolutely. I remember for McDonald's, you know, one of the biggest things at the time, it's probably changed, but it was the 3-minute drive time was their trade area. And so I'd drive, you know, I'd have my location and then drive in a three-minute radius around that location and then plot it on a map. Back then we used like real maps that I would draw the polygon on in 3 minutes and plot the points. And then we had demographic software where we would calculate the population in that area. And then there was all kinds of calculations like, okay, X amount of people translate into X amount of sales. And even in the midst of all that, just natural barriers, if there was an interstate or bridge or something that kind of separated trade areas was a big deal. And that's all an understanding that transferred over from, you know, from McDonald's to the self-storage business, because so much of it is, again, is understanding the trade area and understanding barriers and so on. One of the big things that just popped in my mind was that I've tried to instill in all the locations I looked at was what we called at McDonald's ease of use. Is for a customer, McDonald's always wanted it to be easy for the customer to get in and out. And then even the design of the property, they wanted it to be very easy to find a parking spot, to pull in, to back out, work in the drive through and so on. Because if it was difficult, customer be like, oh man, that's too much of a pain in the butt. Let me go somewhere else or do it. Yeah, exactly. You know, and storage is the same thing. Like, granted, people aren't going to storage every day and so on, but I still think it's ease of use with the site design, with the parking. If you're building a multi-story property, where to put the elevator so there's not, you know, 500-foot walk for the customer and so on. So, anyway, without that, like I said, I couldn't imagine doing what I've been doing for the last 20-some years.
Yeah, those are like the soft skills that you don't think of, right? That they're very transferable. But it makes a lot of sense. Why put up extra barriers, you know, for your customers? You know, if you can figure all that out and take all that out in the design side, then it's, you know, just less barriers, right? For to serve them. That's great. Awesome. Right.
Yeah, so, we want to make our customers make it as easy as possible for them to get in the building, you know, whatever that may be. Absolutely.
Exactly. No, that's tremendous. So I would say, you know, our listener base is at least 50, if not more than 50%, probably multifamily buy and hold investors, maybe some flippers. And I did have some conversations recently. When I say recently, probably over the last month or two. With some listeners that are here locally and some not local, but we got a call. We were just networking in general, having conversations about multifamily, but they were also saying that they were looking at getting started in self-storage. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I have something for you in a couple of weeks. Right. I'm like, I'm talking to this guy, you know, he's been doing this for 20 plus years. So why self-storage, you know, just to start off there, why self-storage and not multifamily? Why not retail? Why not something different?
Yeah. Good question. Let me back up to something you said. I think that that's a common switch, or that with the multifamily asset class, there's a lot of people in that looking to get in the storage business. I'm in the process of selling one of our properties, and three or four of the buyers were in the multifamily space, or that's where they made most, that's where they have most of their assets, and are now starting to get into the storage space as well. And I think it's because of cap rates and mm-hmm. you know, apartment, multifamily, it's crazy pricing right now. And so on. So yeah, I want to echo that point. It's becoming more and more, the norm for people to come from multifamily to storage. And so to answer your question, so why storage, you know, when I started in 99, a good friend of mine and I became partners. You know, we knew each other well. We used to work out together and play basketball, and he knew he had his own development brokerage company. He was real an entrepreneur, creative guy. And he knew I was getting bored at McDonald's, and McDonald's was great, but you know, in North and South Carolina, in many ways, there's only a certain amount of sites mm-hmm. find on a daily basis. And there was four or five of us doing what I was doing, mm-hmm. you know, so our territories weren't that big, which made us the experts in them. So I understand that, but it was just, you know, you kind of get it down, and I was getting bored and was looking for, he's like, hey man, I know, you know, you're getting a little bored there. He goes, let's build storage facilities. You know, he's like, hey, a friend of ours had a piece of land.
Sure.
In the area, and I looked at it, and I was like, okay, you know, and it was a guy that I trusted, and it was a good friend, and our wives are friends, and so on. So, you know, that's how I got into it. And you know, in many ways, I feel very lucky that we got in it that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, just because it's been such a good asset class, you know, since then. I wish, you know, in the last 20 some years, I wish I bought every property I ever looked at that was an 8 or 9 cap. Because if I did, we wouldn't be talking, because I would be somewhere else doing something else.
Yeah.
Because back then, I mean, you know, an 8 cap was, you know, was pricey. I remember, you know, and then when they went down to 7 caps, everybody's like, oh no, 7 caps. Oh, what are we going to do? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, anyway, so that's how I got into it. And it's, and, you know, really, I love it for its simplicity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like the apartment multifamily game where, you know, someone leaves an apartment, you know, you got paint, carpet, whatever you may have to do in that storage. You sweep the unit. Hopefully they took their stuff out, because a lot of customers don't. They think we're the garbage can. And you sweep their unit, you know, and roll on. And so, and the other thing is overhead. I think that's the big mm-hmm. advantage, you know. So I have, you know, 1.5 to 2 employees max at a property, mm-hmm. you know, which if you think, you know, if our average asset price is, let's just say $5 million, I mean, mm-hmm. it fluctuates obviously, but, you know, and so I have 1 or 2 people running that asset, you know, that's good economy. You know, that's easy for the person managing that person. And it's easy to scale that as well. So that's the other thing that I think was a huge benefit to owning them, which I didn't know at the time. But now I'm like, oh, wow, much rather own storage than an office building or multifamily.
Oh, that's great. So you touched on cap rates. What are cap rates right now, would you say, at least in your market?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a loaded question, because there's so many ways, you know, 5 to 6.5%. Mm-hmm. I mean, some bigger A+ locations are 4, 4.5. I mean, you know, and many people now aren't even buying it on the existing cap rate. They'll buy it they'll buy it on a year out cap rate projections. Yeah. And that's how they sell it to their investors, is like, they don't really even talk about what the current cap rate is. You know, they focus on, well, you know, our going in year one cap rate is versus what it is now. And so this property that I'm selling, that cap rate is probably a little bit north of 6. Mm-hmm. And this is a smaller market that I would have never imagined we could sell it for that when we bought it 5.5 years ago. Like I just, it wasn't even in the ballpark. I just didn't think it's a suburb, not even a suburb. It's just a little small town outside of Charlotte. But people are chasing cash flow and yield, right? I mean, that's what it is
everywhere.
Yes. They don't care what it is. And I had 16 letters of intent on this property. Wow. And all but 3 of them were legit. So 13 of them were from good buyers that I knew that had the money, that were in the business, that I could Google them and search their locations. So it was crazy. It makes it hard to buy. If you're a buyer, I'm a buyer and seller.
Yeah.
It makes it very hard to buy because my money's not as cheap as a lot of these bigger buyers.
Right. Yep. That makes sense. So I want to kind of take this in a little different direction. So I guess what would you say are some of the common mistakes that you might see new self-storage investors make, especially maybe new investors just getting into the market now, or maybe they entered the market a couple of years ago, just meeting new investors? What are common mistakes that you see?
Yeah, great question. I used to do some speaking with some new developer seminars, and I would start off by saying, hey, the only reason I'm up here because of all the mistakes that I made. What not to do. I know what not to do. Yeah. And so on. So, I think what comes to my mind as you ask that question, Jeremy, is it's a retail business. Storage is a retail business. It's not a real estate business. The day, whether you're building it or you buy it, it's a retail business, and it needs to be managed like a retail business in terms of customer service, your website, your answering the phones, curb appeal, all of that stuff is important to non-retail businesses, but storage, it's very, very critical to look at it that way. And I think that's what some mistakes that people make is, oh, I'm buying a storage facility and it'll just rent itself and the world's great and storage is a great business. And no, it's not that like that. It's hard, but you can make money at it. But that's what comes to my mind. The first thing is that it's retail business.
Yeah, it obviously is. I didn't intuitively think of it that way until you just said that. But it's that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. The other thing that comes to mind is and this kind of ties into that, is that the on-site property manager is the most important person there. I mean, I've seen a property that we owned, bought it at 38% occupied. That's a long story why we can bought a property at 38% occupied. It was our second one we bought, so we didn't know what we were doing. And we're like, just buy it. Seems like a good deal. We can operate it. We're better than this company. And it was 38% when we bought it. And it was like, 45 2 years later. So we didn't make – it wasn't a good story. But – my point to that is then I hired the right manager. In the market, this was a coastal market and nothing changed all that much. And I hired this right, a much better manager who was actually in the apartment business, multifamily. I hired her and she took it from that occupancy 45, 50% up to 90% in like 6 months.
Wow.
I mean, it was amazing. Like, there weren't any macro factors in the market that change or micro factors. It was just, she was good with the customers. And so that's the other thing is I think people, especially nowadays, there's companies out there in the storage business that are doing all remote access, everything online, contactless rentals. And I get that. And that will continue to grow. And it's an important aspect, but there are certain markets that I believe that customers like to see and touch and feel the units, a person, have an interaction. And so I think that the importance and quality of that person cannot be underestimated. And so I recommend to people in our own portfolio and even others that I talk to, like, I would pay more money to get the right person, you know, because if you think of there's an asset that's worth, you know, $5 million, really the salary for that on-site person, if it's $40,000, is high. You know what I mean? So I'm paying someone $40,000 to manage an asset that's worth $5 million. Like those ratios are off. I mean, it's good as an owner, but like, because what we ask them to do, you know, they need to handle conflict, right? They need to sell. Mm-hmm. They need to be a maintenance person in many ways. You know, then they need to lead and manage any of the vendors, and so on. So I couldn't do it. Like that skill set that line managers have is more well-rounded than mine. Like,
sure.
That's the other thing is I pay for the right person, which again, these things aren't, when you hear them, you're like, oh yeah, duh, makes sense. But like, it's really important to understand.
It's when you're evaluating probably a new asset and you see management cost, you're always thinking how to drive down expenses, right? So definitely don't cut there. Like if the person's not doing a good job, find a new person.
Right.
But don't skimp on the management costs for the right person.
Absolutely. Never. No way. No chance. Yeah. It's not worth it at all.
Yeah. That's good feedback. I actually had I thought of a question beforehand that I wanted to ask, and you touched real briefly on it. The technology, you know, is changing, you know, real estate, tons of sectors all across the board in the economy, right? Multifamily, there's a lot of technology that's being used. Self-storage, you mentioned about technology with not having managers on site, doing everything remotely. How do you see that? In some markets, it works. Some markets, it doesn't work. How do you see that affecting the industry today, in the future? Just kind of like your crystal ball on it.
Yeah. I think it's going to become more and more acceptable to not have a manager. You know, but again, that I'm old school. I've been in it so long like that. That makes me a little nervous, everything I said earlier. But I think, you know, a friend of mine, All Day Op, that I know, that was actually an intern for me way back when I started, has a storage portfolio, and they are all managerless properties. It's all remote, not one. And they have a website, and they got a call center, and they do everything remote. And it's working, and they've raised a ton of money. And you know, they buy smaller properties, which makes sense, right? Buy smaller properties. You know, they're anywhere from 15 to 40,000 square feet. You know, and that's a little bit more manageable to run that way. But I think it's only going to continue. I think the other thing that's being rolled out is this, it's kind of a hybrid. It's the contactless rentals is what it is. So the REITs, the big boys, Life Storage, Public Storage, Extra Space, CubeSmart, you know, this contactless where somebody could rent a unit 24/7 all on the web, and then can actually go do all the paperwork, sign the lease, do everything, and then go move into their unit without ever meeting the manager. And so that's becoming more and more prevalent. And to me, Life Storage is the one that, you know, they started doing that 2 years ago, before COVID, and it really helped them through COVID because they already had the systems and the networks in place, because people they were afraid of the contact, right? I mean, and so, so on. So that's the other big thing. And I think too, with, you know, the website SEO, you know, I remember when I started, we had, you know, yellow page advertising. Some of your listeners probably don't even know what yellow page advertising is. Yellow page advertising is. And that was like our biggest expense, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. And now it's yellow page. What are yellow page? I bet my kids don't even know what yellow pages are. You know, so it's the SEO and just, you know, continuing to refine that. You know, to help with the searches, so when people when people need it, they can find it.
Right. Interesting. No, I appreciate your insight on that. So, looking at let's say someone's interested in buying, you know, they found a property that looks interesting to them in their area or in an area that they're looking in, underwriting on an existing facility. Like, let's say you're going to go in and buy an existing facility, you're going to do some renovations, you're going to either put new management in. What do you look at to be able to underwrite that location, that building, for what you want to do to it? What do you look at specifically?
Right. And so this is existing location, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The first thing is the P&Ls, you know, is obviously look at the revenue, but my first glance is looking at the operating expenses and trying to see if they're, you know, quote, real. Mm-hmm. Many sellers just have these operating expenses that run it in a way that most people can't, you know? Yeah. And so on. So just looking at the operating expenses and the maintenance and repairs is always a big line item. You know, is the seller have enough money in there in maintenance and repairs in the history of it so that there's no surprises? You know, the other thing that in related to that is also to just understand the capital expenditures the last couple of years. You know, have they been keeping it up so that if I would buy it, are there going to be any surprises in 3-5 years to replace a metal roof or driveway, you know, things like that. But the first thing is looking at the operating expenses in the P&L. The other line item obviously is occupancy, you know, and then rental rates is the other big thing, is to understand what are the rental rates in that market. Mm-hmm. And how is this property in comparison to the competition? Are they way above? Are they way below? Are they at market? You know, and depending on where they are, you know, you have to adjust the strategy. You know, I built a property in Wilson, North Carolina, way back when, and the rental rates were way, way low, which I knew that, but this was the second one we built. And again, wasn't really sure what we were doing. And the rental rates were really low. And we're like, oh my gosh, everything has to go well for us to make money on this. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because there was no margin for error. Like looking back now at that deal, you couldn't give me the land to build that property. You know what I mean? Because the rental rates...
The demand wasn't there, right? Yeah.
Yeah. The demand was, I mean, the
okay.
It was just the unit demand was, but just the market rental rates with a bunch of smaller operators that were giving away units at low prices, you know, just made it very hard to drive revenue. Mm-hmm. Like that. Does that make sense? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If there was 8 competitors that were renting a 10x10 for $50, you know, I better not have my pro forma at 80.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, why would somebody like storage is a commodity. Like, does anybody really care which one they go to? I mean, maybe there are some people, but like it, you know, pricing and security and so on. So, that's the other big thing. I lost my train of thought there, but anyway, I just wanted to share.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So that I was going to ask then underwriting for like development land. So you touched, that's I guess more market research on the current supply of what's in. That kind of brings you back to your McDonald's days, like the current area right there. I'm sure you go to a certain radius, right, of current units in a certain radius, and then looking what is currently being rented, occupancies at different sites, right? What they're charging. What radius do you typically look at? And does it change between, like, if you're looking rural, if you're looking like more not in a city, but closer to a city?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I look at all the, you know, 1-3-5 miles to me, typically.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, even at McDonald's, underwriting a location is an art than it is a science. So look at that and just kind of put it all together. And I think, yeah, to your point on a rural location, you expand that a little bit. And to your point, when I look at that, a development location, again, similar thing, I look at the rents first. What are the rents in the market? Mm-hmm. You know, and people always ask me, one of the first questions they ask me is, well, how much can you pay for this land? I'm like, I don't know. What are the rents? You know, yeah. Because the rents are in the market for a 10 by 10 are 180 for a climate control versus 100. Well, I can pay a lot more for that land, mm-hmm. you know, with the rents at 180 than at 100. I mean, again, that intuitively, that makes sense. Like, well, it's just math. Right. Well, yeah, it is. But until I know what the rents are, I have no idea. And now that's all these numbers are skewed because now so many people are building multi-story properties, mm-hmm. which, you know, the back when I started building, you know, 20%, 20-25% of the storage was climate control. The rest was non-climate control. You know, nowadays, obviously, with someone's going multi-story, it's basically 100% climate control. Mm-hmm. And so your rents are a lot more on a per square foot basis because it's 100% climate control.
Sure.
So on. So then you can pay, yeah, obviously can pay more for the land mm-hmm. at that stage.
Okay. No, that's good info. I wanted to ask a question on the debt financing. Like, you know, with multifamily, depending how large you go, you can get, you know, there's Fannie and Freddie. You also go to local bank, credit union. What's typical in self-storage? I do know I heard people talk about SBA as an option sometimes, but what's typical on some of your deals?
Yeah, it would be, you know, on a development deal or an acquisition or both.
Both.
So I would say, let me start on the development deal because I'm thinking about that. Mm-hmm. The last deal that we built was an SBA loan, mm-hmm. Which worked out well. I mean, the advantage of that is you have to come up with less equity. You know, mm-hmm. you can finance more, which makes, you know, if you have investors and are raising money, it makes the numbers look better. The challenge with SBA is just the paperwork and it's a pain, you know, it's just a lot of stuff, but it's worth it. You just got to get through it and know what you're getting into. The other thing is, at least with our SBA lender, you know, the rate was a little bit higher than the market, you know, than everybody else. And that's the trade-off is the interest rate versus less equity. So that was our last development deal. Other development deals I've done have been, you know, local bank financing, you know, and these on a development deal, we're all personally guaranteed, you know, so then there's the issue of the guarantors need to be strong enough to support, to be able to get the loan and let the bankers okay. underwrite it. As far as, and then what happens on a development deal like that, then you build it, lease it up, hopefully get it stabilized, and then you take it out to the either CMBS market or life insurance companies or so on. That's when it gets fun in the business because you've taken all the risk. Now you're taking the risk off the table, mm-hmm. getting off the loan guarantees and so on. And then, you know, you can use some other bank resources. And so acquisition is, you know, is more of a hybrid. It depends on, you know, is it a stabilized deal? Is it one a value add? Mm-hmm. You know, depending on if you do need guarantees or not. The other thing is guarantees are obviously not obviously, but related to how much debt you're looking. You know, are you trying to get 50% equity in debt? You know, back in the day when we started, we were trying to leverage it up as high as we can. We didn't have any money. we didn't have any money, so just try to get. And back then, you could get a lot more than you can now because I think now, you know, it's 65% maybe.
Okay.
Debt on the cost of the deal on an acquisition, you know, I mean, you can push it and so on, but it wasn't like 85% like we used to be able to do on this. So it's just, and again, one of the things I wanted to say, Jeremy, is, and this reminds me, is like anybody that gets into this business, mm-hmm. I recommend them to assemble a team, you know, get a team of people, whether that's a broker, a lender, a mortgage broker, you know, a surveyor, an architect, a metal building guy, you know, like, and there's a lot of people out there that do all this and that specialize in storage. And you want them to have experience in the storage business. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to spend my money training an engineer on how to design a self-storage site.
Right.
You know, because there's a lot of nuances with step down on a drive-up, you know, with step downs and drainage and flow and all this stuff that I don't want to have to train him on how to design it. And I've seen too many people who are getting into the business that had somebody who wasn't experienced in the nuances of storage. And I look at a site plan or a unit mix or something, I'm like, oh my gosh, no, this isn't going to work, or it'll work, but man, there's so many better ways to do it. So I think that's another big point that I just wanted to emphasize to your listeners is like, get the team and get the team with experience, because that'll save you a lot of headaches going down the road. And the other thing is, to me, the people in the storage business are very friendly and are willing to help. I mean, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people over 20 years, you know, where if I charge a consulting fee, I'd be a rich man. And just because, I mean, I'm not like, just because they're asking me different questions and what I'm going to do, charge them, you know, $100 an hour, or $200, like just helping them out. Like, because when I got into the business, that's what somebody did for me.
Yeah.
You know, is I didn't know anything.
Paid for it.
Yeah. And he just helped me out, and I'd ask him, you know, and so, you know, that's the other thing. There are people out there in this business that want to help you.
Yeah.
You know, and don't have their hand out just looking, you know, looking for the fee to kind of just tell you something that they forgot, that they didn't even know that they knew.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. I mean, just an example, you know, I found a land up here in our area, and how many calls we had back and forth, and didn't work out for one reason or another, but absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Just
the knowledge. And like you said, the team, like, I don't know what the quote is, but it's, you know, it's good to learn from your experiences, but it's better to learn from others. Mm-hmm. Experiences, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's huge.
No, that's great. So let's say next step suggestion. So let's say there's an investor who's either just come across self-storage, or maybe has been investing in real estate for a while, kicking around the idea of getting into storage. What is one piece of advice that, you know, you could provide that's like an actual actionable step that they could, you know, after listening to this episode, whenever they listen to it, they can actually put in place today, tomorrow, to start walking down that path of getting closer to buying a building or finding land, developing, you know, whatnot. What would you have out there for them?
Right. Good question. Two things pop up. Hopefully I'll remember the second one. The first one is, you know, if you're in a specific market, I would just start Googling all the storage. Put self-storage near me in your phone or in Google, and they'll pop up. they'll all pop up on Google Maps. It's beautiful. Back to my McDonald's days when I'd have to write BK for Burger King on maps. Anyway, you don't have to do that. So I would just do that, and then I would just start looking at the rental rates, you know, and just seeing what does a 10 by 10 rent for. You know, and that's kind of the industry standard. That's a gauge, a quick gauge of kind of the market is a 10 by 10. That's the first thing I would do, is just to get a feel for it. And then also, I remember when I was at McDonald's, one of the things that we did is we would plot all the McDonald's on a map, and then we'd plot all the competitions, and then we'd look at the map and be like, okay, where are the holes?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there's, you know, where's the growth? Where are the holes? Oh, okay. Maybe we should look here. I mean, again, it's not rocket science, but, you know, it's just an element of details to do that. And storage is the same way. As you look at them, you could be like, huh, there's none in this trade area. Why? It could be zoning. You know, there's a ton of reasons why. That's one. The second, I did remember my second one. So, is, I would then just Google self-storage brokers and then start looking at packages, mm-hmm. you know, and reach out to somebody and say, hey, you know, or go to list list.com, or yeah, is it list self storage or list.com that has a bunch of list self storage listings, or mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many brokers now in the business. And just problem is, you're then going to get hammered with packages if you do that. But that's okay. But that, I can't tell you how many I've looked through, and it's also a great educational. We're all, there's some like in Oklahoma that I look at, not that I'm going to buy a property in Oklahoma, but I just curious to see, you know, what's happening, where are the rent rates there, what's going on, and so on. So that was the other thing I would do, just to begin to look at, you know, the financials of a property and start looking at the valuations and cap rate, or what are they asking, and so on, like just to get involved in it, because there's no substitute for diving in.
Absolutely.
Like that. You know, I was listening to buy and sell some stocks. Like, that's just fascinated me. And so one of the things that people tell you is like, you will never pay attention to a stock like you will when you own it. Sure. You know, like paper trade and, oh yeah, what's Apple doing? And but when you own Apple, you know, you're going to check that every day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so if you're, it's storage, the same thing. I'm not saying you need to own a storage, but you know what I mean? To get in there and to dive in and to really start to get your feet wet, to begin to understand just some of the nuances, of that, and how people package the properties as well.
Absolutely. No, I think those are really good two key action steps that people can take. So thanks for sharing that.
Yep. You're welcome.
So Bruce, I like to, as a final question on all our interviews, I like to ask, you know, what daily habits do you have to keep you at like your top of your game, or that you attribute to your success?
Mm, good question. Working out, you know, some type of exercise. I would like to do it every day. I don't, but I think just working out. And just whether that's being outside or going for a walk. The other thing that I've started to do as I've gotten a little older is I will just take a 10-minute break and go walk a little bit. You know, it's amazing what that does to my brain, and just listen to some music and go walk and then come back and engage in whatever I'm doing. So, and then I'm going to give you another one. The other one was sleep. Not getting enough sleep is kind of memorialized, and I don't think that's healthy for your mind and brain and body as well. So those are, and I got one more. I think too is also pay attention, meaning just pay attention to what am I doing now? What am I doing in this moment? Am I wasting time on the internet when I should be, you know, I'm reading about Chris Paul playing well last night in the NBA game, or am I Googling self-storage facilities, you know, and just be able to catch yourself, which I think just, and in today's world, you know, all these apps, all the social media, all the internet, it's designed to take us away from where we want to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like the pop-ups and all this stuff, it's designed for us to look around and do all different things. And I think those people that are the most successful that I know pay attention and are diligent with what they're paying attention to and doing it intentionally.
Yep.
So they don't wake up, oh my gosh, I just spent 2 hours on Facebook or on Instagram or where the day, you know? So that's actually, if I had to answer your question over again, I would say pay attention first would be the first thing that I would say.
No, that's good feedback. I mean, it's all those things that they're like attention grabbers, right? It's just, I just finished the book for the second time. I read it, the 12 week year. And it talks about being very intentional on your weekly and daily habits, because, you know, instead of having like an annual plan, have a 12 week plan, and then every day counts, right? Don't waste away a day, because that's when you actually get your work done.
Absolutely. Yeah,
that's great.
Great book on that. There's just remind me of a great book called Tiny Habits.
Tiny Habits.
It just gets into describes how to build habits, and the three elements of that, which is, you know, motivation, ability, and prompt. Like, we only act when we have the motivation, have the ability or some prompt us to it. Anyway, it's a people that are it's just fascinating. Best book on habit building I've ever read as well. So it's just
that's great. I have to pick that up.
Good stuff. Anyway,
awesome. So Bruce, in closing, how can our listeners learn more about you or, you know, get in touch with you if they have any questions or anything like that?
Yeah, just call me, 843-331-2339, or email me, initial B, last name Stan Cavage. Maybe you'll put that in the show notes.
I'll put it in the show notes, yeah.
Email me or call me, you know. Yeah, it's not that hard.
Awesome.
I'd love to talk to any of your listeners or anybody pick my brain or have any questions. So be good stuff.
Sounds good. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for your time today. And to our listeners, if you see that we're providing value, again, leave us with a 5-star rating on iTunes, provide some feedback, tell 5 others about our show. Really appreciate it. Everyone, this is Bruce Stankavage. I'm Jeremy Moyer with the Real Estate Investor MBA. Please tune in with us next time. We'll see you then. Thank you.